And this, the first proceedings of the Supreme Court of Texas outside of Austin since 1892. The court has three matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of their presentation, they are as follows. MCI Telecommunications Corporation versus Texas Utilities Electric Company from Tarrant County. Scott Bradley versus the State of Texas on the relation of Dale White, also from Tarrant County. And in this afternoon's argument, Billy Carl Stevens and Rory Ross versus American Home Assurance Company, a certified question from the United States Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit. In each of these arguments, the court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present its argument. The petitioner or appellant may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising the marshal of the court. We will take a brief recess in between the first and second arguments, and then we will take a lunch break before we come back to hear the third argument. We're privileged to have in the audience today, among others, the justices of the courts of the Court of Appeals for the 10th District in Texas that sits here in Waco, and Senator Jeff Wentworth from San Antonio, who sponsored the constitutional amendment that permitted the Supreme Court to sit outside of our home in the state capitol. The court is now ready to hear argument from petitioner in MCI versus Texas Utilities.
May it please the court, Mr. Robert Gilbreth will present argument for the petitioner. The petitioner has reserved 3 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, my name is Robert Gilbreth, and together with Mr. Richard Valdez, I represent the petitioner, MCI. The overarching issues in this case
Mr. Gilbreth, may I ask you a question first?
Yes, Your Honor.
How did you preserve your no evidence point of error on Dr. Buchanan's testimony?
On Dr. Buchanan's testimony, Your Honor, we preserved it with a motion for judgment notwithstanding the verdict, I believe, Your Honor. However, I would like to verify that and answer the Justice's question directly on rebuttal, if I may, sir. The overarching issues in this case are, number one, whether the expert testimony that resulted in an expert being sanctioned by the state is legally sufficient evidence, and then, number two, whether the line between tort and contract should be blurred by freewheeling application of the third-party beneficiary doctrine. The facts of this case can be summed up quite briefly. TU built a power line along a railroad under a license agreement with MOPAC. Approximately 12 years later, MCI laid fiber optic cable along the same railroad under an easement agreement with MOPAC. TU was not a party to that agreement between MCI and MOPAC. In some places, MCI laid its cable near TU's electric poles. Over 7 years later, TU determined that some of those electric poles were leaning. This litigation resulted in TU sued MCI, asserting a negligence cause of action and a breach of contract cause of action. After a bench trial, the trial court rendered judgment awarding TU its attorney's fees for awarded TU its attorney's fees and damages for the past and future costs to replace the electric, the poles, or the foundations for those electric poles. So in other words, the damages were completely unrelated to the subject matter of the contract between MCI and MOPAC. The first issue I'd like to address is the legal sufficiency of the evidence on causation. TU's claim can best be described by the logical fallacy post hoc ergo propter hoc. Basically, TU argues that its poles did not lean until after MCI laid its cable, and therefore it was the cable laying that caused the poles to lean. Well, I will focus my argument on the testimony of TU's hired expert, Dr. Philip Buchanan, because the conclusions offered by TU's employee, an engineer named Mike McWilliams, are nothing more than ipsy-dixit conclusions that are not supported and do not support the judgment independently of Dr. Buchanan's
Didn't
testimony.
Didn't MCI take the position in the trial court that the expert testimony offered by both parties was conflicting?
Your Honor, yes, Your Honor.
And then as a result of that, the trial court made fact findings relating to the element of proximate cause.
That's correct, Your Honor. But
there was no objection to the introduction of the expert's testimony at the trial court.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, there was, when this expert, Dr. Philip Buchanan, testified, this matter was raised, to paraphrase Justice Gonzalez from the Maritime case, it was extensively ventilated in the trial court.
I understand, but what objection was raised to Dr. Buchanan's testimony at any time before he testified in the trial court?
Before he testified, there was none, Your Honor. This was a bench trial, so there was no motion in limine, and no direct objection was made before he testified. It was raised for the first time during cross-examination. MCI's trial attorney discovered the errors in his calculations the Saturday before trial.
And then having pointed out those errors in his calculations through cross-examination, then put in the hands of the trial court the question of whether or not to believe the expert or not. Correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. But TU itself admits that on page 13 of the brief that Buchanan was hired to determine whether Mr. McWilliams' conclusions could be confirmed. Now, to prove that to prove that MCI's trenching caused the poles to lean, TU had to prove that the pole foundations were adequate in the absence of any trenching. MCI argued that the pole foundations were not adequate, and this argument was obvious because when TU moved its electric poles, it doubled the depth of the foundations from 10 feet, the original foundation, to 20 feet. Well, Dr. Buchanan concluded that MCI's trenching caused the poles to lean rather than inadequate pole foundations, but cross-examination revealed he was able to do so only through improper application of an engineering formula. So the evidence that TU offered to prove causation was based on faulty engineering analysis.
Why wasn't that up to the trial court to decide?
Because it was on the factual sufficiency standard. However, we've asserted a legal sufficiency challenge to the evidence, and the evidence offered by Dr. Buchanan amounts to no evidence.
Well, is your argument on appeal then that the expert testimony is not reliable under Rule 702?
We're not challenging Dr. Buchanan's testimony as based on unreliable science, so I do not think this is a Robinson challenge, Your Honor. He purported to rely on good engineering scientific principles. It's just that he misapplied those principles. So I do not believe this is a Robinson challenge.
Why is it for this court to decide? Isn't that a fact-finding that you're asking this court to make, whether or not he misapplied his science?
It goes to the legal sufficiency of the evidence, Your Honor.
If we have an expert who testifies, and you're here telling this court that his calculations were error, doesn't that require a fact-finding that, in fact, his calculations were wrong?
I think not, Your Honor. I think that by looking at the expert's testimony, you can determine whether it has any foundation, any basis. If it's completely unsupported by the science he purports to rely on, it amounts to no evidence. So it is a legal sufficiency review.
Well, then why do you say it's not a Robinson case?
Because we're not contending that Buchanan relied on unreliable science. And that's what the Robinson-type line of cases goes to, is where an expert attempts to rely on some sort of novel science.
Well, what about Gamble versus Jack William Chevrolet?
Even that case, Your Honor, talks about a gap between the credibility of the evidence offered by the expert. Here, I do not believe that case stands for the proposition that where an expert attempts to rely on sound engineering principles but misapplies the formula, that is a Robinson-type challenge.
Let's assume that you have a different type of case. You have an accounting type case that requires accounting experts to testify on both sides. And the accounting expert who testifies on behalf of the plaintiff lays out figures showing that damages would amount to $1 million. When in reality, after the case is over with, before it comes time for appeal, it's determined mathematically that there was a huge mistake made, that $1 million, no possible way for it to add up to $1 million. Under your theory, could it not then be argued after trial, before appeal, on appeal, that there is no evidence to support the jury award that awarded exactly what the accountant came up with?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe that under my theory that argument could be made. But
So if under those circumstances, then, we have a situation where parties believe pre-trial and during trial that they've done all that they possibly could do to prove up their case without any objection being made to it, and then they would learn for the first time on appeal that their case has been gutted.
That may be, but that is not this case, Your Honor. In this case,
Let me understand that, but if we rule, it seems to me that arguably if we rule according to the way you would like us to, that rule would stand for the proposition that would result in the accounting case being the way that I just set it out. Would it not?
I think that's correct, Your Honor. But in this case...
So if that's the case, then what that means is that we will forever be reevaluating on appeal for the first time the exact veracity of what the expert was able to prove up, and that will give courts of appeals the power to go back and give a thorough reexamination of all the facts underpinning the expert's conclusions.
That, in theory, yes, Your Honor, but I don't think that's going to happen because I think in cases as happened here, the opposing counsel will raise the errors during cross-examination. The matter will be brought up at trial as it was here. Here, for example, the issue was raised on the first day of trial.
Why would it not be better to go ahead and lay behind the log if you know you can prove that the expert has made a calculation mistake? To me, it seems like it may be more prudent to go ahead and lay behind the log. If the jury doesn't come back in your favor, bingo, you know you're going to win on appeal.
I think most parties are not that confident that they can win a legal sufficiency or even a factual sufficiency challenge to the evidence in the Court of Appeals. I think that in most cases, an attorney will be eager to raise the mathematical, in your example, the problem with the calculations immediately, either to discredit the expert before the jury or just to get it on the record. I don't think that that will happen, that attorneys will wait till appeal. But here in this case, for example, the matter was raised the first day of trial through cross-examination, and Dr. Buchanan could not explain away the errors in his calculations. So the judge, this was a bench trial, the judge said, well, you go home tonight and try to figure it out and come back the next day, come back tomorrow. The next day, Dr. Buchanan said, well, I'm relying on a slightly different formula. So MCI's trial attorney moved for a continuance. The judge then said, well, I'm not going to give you a continuance, but he essentially did. He sent the parties home for 14 days and said, I've given you 2 weeks to get together to try to figure out what's going on here and come back. And then before the third and final more than a month before the third and final day of trial, MCI's attorney filed a motion with the court that, among other things, asked the court to appoint a master with an engineering background who could try to figure out and assist the court with the discrepancies in the math. So this matter was extensively ventilated in the trial court. So even if this were a Robinson-type challenge, we have satisfied the obligation to raise it in the trial court. A formal objection, this court has held that, you know, a formal objection is not necessarily required. It's the matter just simply must be raised.
To bring a matter up on appeal, you would agree, would you, Mr. Gilbreath, that you have to be complaining about some ruling or action taken by the trial court, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor, yes.
What ruling are you complaining about that the trial court made?
We are complaining about the trial court's basing its judgment on legally insufficient evidence.
So you are complaining about the trial court's fact-finding then based upon the conflicting expert testimony?
Yes, Your Honor. The final issue that I'd like to address is whether TU should be permitted to enforce MCI's promises to MOPAC under the third-party beneficiary doctrine. Now, to claim standing as a third-party beneficiary and thereby recover attorney's fees in what is nothing more than a tort case, TU seized on MCI's promise to MOPAC that it would not interfere with, quote, existing prior rights. Well, perhaps the most generous observation that can be made about TU's breach of contract claim is that it is superfluous. Not even TU will dispute that had there been no contract at all between MCI and MOPAC, it still would have been able to maintain an action sounding in tort against MCI. But to recover attorney's fees, TU has attempted to create a contort by misusing the third-party beneficiary doctrine. In cases like Southwestern Bell versus Delaney and the more recent DSA versus Hillsborough, this court has refused to blur the lines between tort and contract.
But if we find that there is evidence of damage and negligence, does this not become a moot issue?
No, Your Honor, because they were awarded attorney's fees, and so if there was no third-party beneficiary standing, there was no breach of contract claim, they should not be entitled to recover attorney's fees.
Thank you.
Which element of third-party beneficiary claim is missing, do you say?
Well, in this case, Your Honor, TU is nothing more than an incidental beneficiary. So to that extent, that's the element. They're not a creditor beneficiary, and they're not a donor.
Well, they have some property on this easement, and the provision in the contract says you will not harm their property. So how is that incidental?
It's incidental, for example, if I may answer your question, Your Honor, with the citation to a couple of cases that are very similar to this case that were not cited in our brief, and I think they will answer your question, Your Honor. Those cases are Clearwater Construction Company versus Gutierrez, and it's at 626 Southwest 2nd, 789, a no-writ case, and Cinco, S-I-N-K-O, versus City of San Antonio at 702 Southwest 2nd, 201. Those are both San Antonio Court of Appeals cases from the 1980s. Because of their similarities, they merit a discussion, and I think they will answer your question, Your Honor. But in Gutierrez, for example, the construction company entered into a construction contract with the Corps of Engineers. The company agreed to take to inspect the job site to ensure that the job was done safely and to minimize accidents and injuries. One employee was killed on the job, and his wife sued the construction company, claiming she was a third-party beneficiary entitled to enforce the construction company's promises to use safety on the job site. The Court of Appeals observed that the wife could be considered a beneficiary of the contract. For example, TU could be considered an incidental beneficiary of this contract, but the court rejected the third-party beneficiary claim because the court recognized that the construction company's promises to the Corps of Engineers to protect the rights of third parties was not intended to create contractual rights in third parties who already have rights sounding in tort, and that's the situation here. TU already had rights sounding in tort against MCI, could maintain an action under the laws of tort. So this general language was not sufficient to overcome the presumption against third-party beneficiaries. And the Cinco case is similar. There, then District Judge Spector refused to submit a plaintiff's third-party beneficiary cause of action to the jury. The plaintiff in that case was a passerby who was injured when she fell into a hole excavated by a construction company under a contract with the City of San Antonio. In its contract with the city, the construction company had promised to take various specific safety precautions to protect persons who might encounter the construction, persons like TU in this case. The Court of Appeals affirmed Justice Spector's decision not to submit the plaintiff's third-party beneficiary claim, stating that once the duties to the general public arising out of the contract are identified, the case should be tried under the rules of tort law rather than as an action for breach of contract. So Gutierrez and Cinco are instructive here because in this case, MCI's duty to TU sounded in tort, not contract. A plaintiff should not be able to misuse the third-party beneficiary doctrine to create a contort in a situation where their actions or their rights sound in tort.
If the contract had named TU and said TU's in our easement out here, and so under the contract will not do anything to interfere with TU's rights and obligation of the easement, would that have satisfied that element you're talking about?
I think so, Your Honor. More specific, direct language like that, because as you know, we have a presumption in this state against third-party beneficiaries, and the court requires very specific language to overcome that presumption. A third party gains a right to enforce a contract when that contract creates a right in the third party. Here, this contract did not create any right in TU. It already had rights sounding in tort.
At trial, was there a finding or a request for finding of any tort-related damages?
Yes, Your Honor. There were findings on the tort cause of action.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is now ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. S.G. John Rowe III will represent the respondent.
May it please the court, may I begin by responding to one of counsel's statements he just made. I believe counsel said that MCI is not making a Robinson challenge in this case. If the court would look at petitioner's supplemental brief, which is the brief that petitioner filed as part of its seeking to have this court take judicial notice of the Professional Engineering Board's hearings against Dr. Buchanan. At pages 4 and 5 of that supplemental brief, petitioner makes this statement after citing Daubert, DuPont, Robinson, Havner, and Maritime. The fundamental principle that expert evidence not founded on valid science does not constitute probative evidence is directly applicable to this case. So I do believe that the petitioner is relying on Robinson and Havner and the line of cases from there, and I also believe that the record clearly reflects that the petitioner wholly failed to make any type of objection, motion, or any other attention-getting device to bring this matter to Judge McGrath's attention at trial. As a matter of fact, there was no objection whatsoever to any of the evidence put on in regard to the foundation's lateral support being removed. There was no objection whatsoever to any of our exhibits. Dr. Buchanan had a table, and from that set out the different poles that it was in his opinion would in reasonable probability fail in the future because of MCI's entrenchments. No objection made to that particular exhibit at all.
Despite your contentions, what about the argument that under Havner and perhaps under Gammel, evidence submitted by an expert that is unreliable constitutes no evidence and therefore could be raised as an issue that could be raised for the first time on appeal?
Well, I understand that to be the argument, Your Honor, but I don't...
Tell me why that is not a valid argument.
I don't believe that is a valid argument for the reasons set forth in those in that opinion and in Maritime.
I think it's a given under Texas jurisprudence, perhaps it's a given, that expert testimony that is not reliable does not constitute evidence, and therefore a strong argument can be made that it can be raised for the first time on appeal, that what the expert provided that the court may have relied upon in rendering a decision was no evidence at all, and therefore judgment should be reversed and rendered.
I believe that is the situation that is present in cases such as condemnation cases today. There are a number of cases in that regard that talk about speculative evidence as far as after taking use of a piece of property. In this particular case, well, to answer your question, if there is no evidence and it doesn't, and for some reason the trial court was so misguided as to think that there was evidence, I agree with you. It's almost like a fundamental error type of proposition, and that's what you're getting to if you follow MCI's argument in this case. It's almost like fundamental error that the court shouldn't have even considered it. It's not a scintilla, or it's no more than a scintilla. I suppose that there are cases that would meet that situation. This is not that case, as we've tried to point out to you. I hope I answered your question.
Thank you. Conroy?
Yes, sir.
It seems to me what's being argued here is that there's a miscalculation that destroys the value of Dr. Buchanan's testimony. So
I agree with you.
Just
you agree that what's being argued, or that
I agree that that was the argument.
Okay.
I think that's the extent of the argument.
Well, let me ask you. So if this case was a case where one expert got up and said 2 + 2 = 4, and another expert got up and said 2 + 2 = 5, and the judge found 5 to be the answer, and there was no objection to that expert's testimony, would it be your opinion that there is, that is some evidence to support the trial court's judgment that 2 + 2 = 5?
That in and of itself is not.
Okay. The argument here is this is simply a miscalculation The formula wasn't used correctly, or the proper input was not put into that formula. Are you arguing that there was no confusion by Dr. Buchanan about what formula he used or what numbers he plugged in, and that if we got two experts up on either side, they could come out with either decisions, either of the answers the experts in this case got?
Yes, I will say that that is the case. But, Your Honor, the distinguishing factor with this case and the one that you just mentioned about 2 plus 2 equals 5 is that there was so much substantial other evidence of record to support Dr. Buchanan's findings in this particular case. As counsel...
Well, if the court concludes that it was simply a miscalculation issue, could, just because there was another expert, I mean, just because your expert says this is the answer, if this court concludes, on appeal or otherwise, that they just didn't plug in the right numbers in this formula, would you agree that that's a no evidence and the trial judge's judgment could not be supported?
Not in this case. No, sir. If 2 plus 2 plus 5 is the entire basis for that expert's opinion, sure, I would agree with you. That's no evidence. But that's not the case here.
So you're not really arguing, you're not arguing that this was a miscalculation case. You're saying forget about that formula, forget about that calculation.
Sure.
The expert based his decision on something else, and that's the evidence that supports the judgment.
Yes, sir. That's what I'm arguing, that there was so much other evidence. And besides that, as I pointed out in my brief, MCI had two experts, two foundation engineers who testified. On cross-examination, they admitted that both of them, using the same exact formula, Brahms method, to determine the depths of foundations, came up with 20 to 25% difference in depths using the same formula. They're two experts. So what if Dr. Buchanan didn't get one particular mathematical problem solved in this case? What happened was that on cross-examination, for the very first time, MCI's counsel, and he did a good job on it, I must congratulate him, MCI's counsel, in cross-examining Dr. Buchanan, used a formula that Dr. Buchanan indicated that he had used previously. And, I mean, it covered a whole poster board, this formula. It's not something that I can explain to the court as to how it works, believe me. I did not have the benefit of a Baylor Law School education. But aside from that, I wish I did. Aside from that, that was not part of my case, was attempting to defend these necessarily. I had so much other evidence, I thought, this is, as the court says, it's just a miscalculation at the most. Specifically, what Dr. Buchanan never recanted his testimony. If you look at his testimony, he says, well, according to your figures, Mr. Defense Counsel, then you're right and I'm wrong as far as that calculation is concerned. He certainly didn't admit that his whole basis for his opinion. As a matter of fact, on rebuttal, he testified that he had gone through here, and what he had missed initially and overlooked during cross-examination was that the principle of reasonableness.
So I'll be clear, though.
I beg your pardon?
So I'll be clear.
Okay.
If an expert testifies that the answer is the product of this formula, and the product is X, and it turns out X is wrong, I mean, it can be demonstrated mathematically or without the aid of facts that are in controversy. If X is wrong, that's no evidence to support a judgment. That's your answer to Judge Enoch's question.
That's no evidence to support his particular opinion?
Well, or a judgment or a verdict or anything.
I can't say that based upon the facts the court just gave me, because I don't know what else he testified
to. No. I mean, assuming there's nothing else.
Oh, it's nothing else.
Just
I agree with you.
Okay.
And that's the whole basis.
Yes.
But
you say there was other testimony as well that supported it.
Yes, sir, quite a bit. But Judge...
Is a necessary part of that the expert has admitted his calculation is in error? What if the expert is saying, no, I think I'm still right? And you've got a conflict between the experts. What is the trial judge supposed to do at that point in time?
Earn his money and make a decision with regard to the observation of these witnesses in front of him. Now, MCI's position was that he ought to appoint a master after we'd been in trial for 3 days. And just to correct perhaps misinformation, the case was actually recessed for 2 or 3 weeks to enable us to, the court ordered us to mediate. And then we went back into trial for one more day, and MCI got the opportunity to put on its rebuttal. I just wanted to make you all aware of that. Now,
what other evidence do you say supports the verdict?
I beg your pardon.
What other evidence supports the judgment besides the testimony of Dr. Buchanan?
Mr. McWilliams, civil engineer, worked on these foundations designed these foundations for 13 years, had designed several hundred of them during that particular point in time. He opined that they failed as a result of MCI's entrenchments and removal of lateral support. In addition to that, I think if you believe what I believe, and that the calculations themselves that Dr. Buchanan supposedly miscalculated, you still have to look at his experience and what he testified to in regard, based upon his experience, based upon his analysis of the soil out there at the site, based upon his experience in designing the foundations of these for some 35 years. That was the difference between my experts and MCI's experts. We had people who actually deal with these transmission line foundations. They had people who had dealt, one of them had never designed a transmission foundation. But I'm just arguing the evidence to you all.
Well, let me clarify. So what you're saying is, leaving aside any potential problems resulting from calculation errors, you're saying that Mr. Buchanan, in and of himself, with regard to his own testimony, provides sufficient support for his conclusions.
Yes, sir. I think that you all specifically left that route open in the Gamble case.
What engineering data backed up McWilliams' opinion?
I'm sorry, I'm getting deaf in my own head.
What engineering data backed up McWilliams' opinion?
Engineering data, the soil tests that were conducted originally in 1973 when these foundations were first put in is among that. Other engineering data is the design factors that he must go through in regard to the depths of these foundations. He has certain procedures that he followed that he explained during the course of his testimony. Now, did he rely upon one particular formula? I can't say that in order to make this determination. No, he did not.
Mr. Chandra, I'm having some difficulty there. This is just a physical property of foundation. If you have the right soil test, know what the tensile strength, I guess, of the soil is, there is a formula that will tell you how deep that foundation needs to be based on the height and weight of the structure they're putting up. I mean, there's no magic to this, is there?
Well,
you follow that formula, it'll tell you how deep that foundation's got to be.
There were about three or four formulas I found out in this case.
But they'll come to, I mean, the foundation isn't going to be much different depending on which formula you use, will it? I mean, I don't know. It's in the ground. I don't know.
Well, you said there were three or four formulas. Did these poles at issue meet the test under any formula, mathematically?
No, they did not meet the test under certain formulas. They did meet the test under Dr. Buchanan's formulas that he had used.
Which Buchanan's formula was brought into doubt based on miscalculation. Right.
Well, if you follow MCI's argument, but then again, Dr. Buchanan refuted that upon rebuttal testimony.
You're about to run out of time. Would you address the other issue?
Yes, sir.
Whether or not the Court of Appeals committed error in finding that you had a cause of action for a contract?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. What I'd like to do is, and you all have raised some questions, if I can show you some of my exhibits that will give you the situation there, and if Mr. Carroll can come around there and show you. And I have prepared a booklet for the court here today that has these exhibits. And the first that I wanted to show you is, well, the very first exhibit shows you what happens when lateral support is removed. It's just a very simple explanation of what occurs there. And those little arrows will show you the tension involved that is put on these. This is an actual piece of the conductor that is used. It weighs a pound per linear foot. There's six of them strung among each between each of these poles, 300 or 400 feet. You can imagine with the wind blowing the pull or the force on these particular poles with this involved. Now, Plaintiff's Exhibit 6 is a picture of this right-of-way. This right-of-way is 200 feet wide. It's 5.2 miles long. And my purpose of showing this is that you're not talking, Judge Gonzales, about an awful lot of people who are going to use that particular right-of-way. Now, let's see the Plaintiff's Exhibit 7 there also. This is just another picture of it. So you're talking about a fairly narrow strip there. MCI makes much in its brief of saying that they paid $2,230,000 in 1985 to be able to utilize that right-of-way, and scoffs at TU for suggesting that TU would have some rights to tell them that you can't put your cable right next to our foundations. But what MCI omits is that $2,230,000 was for 2,090 miles of right-of-way all over the country, which works out to about $1,070 a mile, I believe. In 1973 dollars, TU Electric paid $106,000 to put its transmission line in 5.2 miles of right-of-way, which works out to something over $20,000 a mile. So I think that if you're talking about who paid for what, TU certainly paid a lot more than MCI did. And then, Matt, if you could show them that last one, too. But again, my point is that your MCI talks in terms of licensees, which are mentioned specifically in the MCI railroad agreement as being members of a broad, vague class, and therefore incidental beneficiaries and not direct beneficiaries of the contract between MCI and the railroad.
Looking at the agreement that you contend your client is a third party beneficiary to, how do you reconcile Section 26 of that agreement, which specifically states that the agreement is not intended to benefit anyone but the parties to the agreement?
There are two ways to reconcile it, Your Honor. One way is that, and this is the way that Judge Day reconciled it, among the ways that Judge Day reconciled it in his opinion in the Court of Appeals, and that is that if you look at it, the title is Succession Non-Assignabilities. Judge Day believed that this shall be construed as being for the benefit of any party not in signatory hereto, referred to those who assignees or successors who had not received the written consent of the other party. The other way he reconciled it, which I think is probably makes more sense to me, is that if you look at the other sections of the contract, and going on the principle that you do not focus, when focusing on a contract, you do not isolate one particular section if there are other sections in contrast to it. You have to harmonize them, and as Justice Kelton did in the Bush versus Brunswick case. And
why isn't this an indication that, in fact, the original signatory to the agreement was just trying to protect itself and make sure it made provisions so that the agreement it had with its licensee, Texas Utilities, was protecting itself? Does that make sense?
I didn't understand you.
Well, I mean, couldn't the agreement, in fact, have made provision to show that the party was intending to protect its licensee or protect itself from actions by its licensee against it without intending it to benefit under the agreement.
It could have said that. But instead, why say that, though, when you've got a specific class of third parties, namely licensees? There's no mystery that TU Electric was out there on that right-of-way. I mean, you can't miss those poles. Thank you all very much.
Any other questions? Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the Court. Your Honor, Justice Baker, your question was how did we preserve the no-evidence challenge? And MCI filed a motion for judgment. It's in the clerk's record at page 214, and the legal sufficiency challenge was raised there, Your Honor. I would like to make the point, Your Honors, and would encourage the Court to carefully examine Buchanan's testimony aside from his faulty engineering analysis, because Buchanan's seat-of-the-pants conclusions, aside from his engineering analysis, amount to no evidence. He was hired, and they've even admitted on page 13 of their brief, they hired Buchanan to see whether he could confirm, and I would put in brackets, Mr. McWilliams' Ipsy-Dixit conclusions, with his engineering analysis. They knew they needed the engineering analysis. That's the only way to determine whether these pole foundations were adequate in the absence of any trenching. And Dr. Buchanan's testimony without, if you discount his improper engineering analysis, amounts to no evidence. Now, Mr. McWilliams' testimony, too, is completely unsupported. Just an example from the record, page 103 of the reporter's record, Mr. McWilliams was asked, did you look into any other causes for the poles leaning over besides MCI's fiber optic cable being in the presence of them? Answer by Mr. McWilliams, I had no reason to look for any other causes, so no, I did not. And then on the next page, he's asked whether he did any analysis of the soil in the trenches to see if it was any weaker than this other surrounding soil, and he says, no, I did not. I would like to also urge the Court to recognize that in the maritime case, the Court's opinion states that the concern was to prevent ambush on appeal, for the first time on appeal, and that's not what happened here. So even if we are making a Robinson challenge to Dr. Buchanan's testimony, there was no ambush for the first time on appeal.
Well,
this matter was addressed.
If you are making a Robinson challenge and you're challenging the reliability of the expert opinion, correct?
I consider a Robinson challenge to be a challenge to the reliability of the science that the expert relies on. Yes.
And if, in fact, that's the kind of challenge, why wouldn't it be necessary for that specific question to be raised with the trial court so that a record could be made by the parties for the trial court to consider about whether or not that is reliable science, and then ultimately for review by the appellate court?
I think that is an appropriate requirement, and I think it was satisfied in this case very extensively. It was raised numerous times, and Dr. Buchanan was given the opportunity to go home and recalculate.
Well, but that's a question of miscalculation, correct? Not
yes.
A question of whether his science was in fact reliable.
But his science, the only way you could say his science was unreliable is because of his miscalculations, Your Honor. The formulas he attempted to rely on are good science. It's just that he...
How do we know that?
Because I don't know that there's anything in the record to say that the Williams formula that he attempted to rely on to prove that it's good science, but I think it's been relied on. It's a 1930 formula, and it's been relied on extensively around the country.
But we don't have a record in which the question of the reliability of various formulas and so on is discussed in the record so that the trial court could make that determination and it ultimately could be reviewed on appeal by the appellate court?
The answer to that question is no, but nobody contested the reliability of the formula, only its application.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
That concludes the first argument this morning, and the court will now take a brief recess.
All right.